to Denning's glass. I guess maybe I should ask one or two of them over.
They'd never leave, Denning's growled, his eyes reddening, and suddenly growing even smaller, each one of them a separate particular hell. They're fucking plunderers.
Chris picked up the tonic bottle to pour, but Denning's testily waved it off.
Now, for heaven's sake, straight. Can't you ever remember? The third one is always straight.
Chris watched him pick up his glass, gulp down the gin, then set the glass back down, and with his head bent, staring into it, he muttered, "Thoughtless bitch." Chris eyed him warily.
Yeah, he's starting to blow, she thought.
She changed the subject from priests to the offer she'd received to direct.
Oh, well, good, Dennings grunted, still looking down into his glass. Bravo, darling.
To tell the truth, though, Burke, this kind of scares me.
Dennings instantly looked up at her, his expression now benign and paternal.
Oh, twaddle, he said. You see, my baby, the difficult thing about directing is making it seem as if the damn thing were difficult. I hadn't a clue my first time out, but here I am, you see. There's no magic involved, love, just bloody hard work, and the constant realization from the day you start shooting that you've got a Siberian tiger by the tail.
Yeah, I know that, Burke, but now that it's real, now that they've offered me my chance, I'm not so sure I could even direct my grandmother across the street. I mean, all that technical stuff.
Oh, now, don't be hysterical. Leave all that nonsense to your editor, your cinematographer, and the script supervisor. Get good ones, and I promise your love, they'll have you smiling through. What's important is your handling of the cast, the performances. And at that, you'd be marvelous, my pretty. You could not only tell them what you want, you could show them.
Chris still looked doubtful.
Oh, well, still, she said.
Still what?
Well, the technical stuff. I mean, I need to understand it.
Well, for instance, give your guru an example.
From there and for almost an hour, Chris probed the acclaimed director to the outermost barricades of minutia. The technical ins and outs of film directing were available in numerous texts, but reading always tended to fray Chris's patience. So instead, she read people. Naturally inquisitive, she would juice them, she would wring them out.
But books were not wringable. Books were glib. They said therefore and clearly, when it wasn't clear at all, and their circumlocutions could never be challenged, they could never be stopped for shrewdly disarming,
"Hey, now hold it, I'm dumb. Could I have that again?"
Books could never be pinned or made to wriggle or dissected. Books were like Carl.
"Darling, all you need is a brilliant cutter," Dennings cackled at the end. "I mean a cutter who knows his doors."
He'd grown charming and bubbly and seemed to have passed the threatened danger point until the voice of Carl was heard.
"Beg pardon? You wish something, madam?"
He was standing attentively at the open door to the study.
"Oh, hello, Thorndyke," Dennings greeted him, giggling. "Or is it Heinrich?" he asked. "I simply can't seem to keep the name straight."
"It is Carl, sir."
"Oh, yes, of course, I'd forgotten. Tell me, Carl, was it public relations that you did for the Gestapo, or was it community relations? I believe there's a difference."
Carl replied politely,
"Neither one, sir. I am Swiss."
"The director, Gafford?" "Yes, of course, Carl. Right, you're Swiss. And you never went bowling with Goebbels, I suppose."
"Knock it off, Burke," Chris scolded.
"Or went flying with Rudolf Hess," Dennings added.
His manner cool and unperturbed, Carl turned his gaze to Chris and asked her blandly,
"Madam wishes?"
"Burke, how about that coffee, huh? What do you say?"
"Oh, well, fuck it," the director declared belligerently, abruptly getting up from the bar and striding out of the room with his head bent forward and his hands clenched into fists.
Moments later, the front door was heard forcefully slamming shut.
Expressionless, Chris turned to Carl and said tonelessly, "Unplug all the phones."
"Yes, madam.
Something else?"
Yeah, how about maybe some decaf?"
"I bring it."
"Where's Rags, Carl?"
"Down in playroom. I call her?"
Yeah, it's bedtime. Oh, no, wait a second, girl. No, never mind. Going down there myself. She'd remembered the bird and was heading for the stairs to the basement. I'll have the decaf when I come back up.
Yes, madam, as you wish.
And for the umpty-eighth time, Carl, I apologize for Mr. Dennings.
I pay no attention.
Chris stopped and turned partway around.
Yes, I know, Carl. That's exactly what's driving him nuts.
Turning back around, Chris walked to the entry hall of the house, pulled open the door to the basement staircase, and began to descend. Hiya, Sticky, what you doing down there? You got that bird done for me yet?
Oh, yes, Mom, come and see. Come on down, it's all finished.
The playroom was paneled and brightly decorated. There were easels, paintings, a phonograph, tables for games and a table for sculpting, red and white bunting left over from a party for the previous tenant's teenage son.
Oh, honey, that's so great, Chris exclaimed,
as Reagan grandly headed for the figure. Not quite dry, it resembled a worry bird and was painted orange except for the beak, which was laterally striped in green and white. A tuft of feathers was glued to the head.
You really like it? Reagan asked, grinning broadly.
Oh, honey, I do. I really do. You got a name for it?
Reagan shook her head.
No, not yet.
What's a good one?
I don't know, Reagan answered, lifting her hands palm upward and shrugging.
Lightly tapping her fingernails against her teeth, Chris furrowed her brow in exaggerated ponder.
Let me see, she said softly, mulling.
Then abruptly she lit up and said, Hey, how about dumb bird, huh? What do you think? Just plain old dumb bird? Reflexively covering her mouth with a hand to hide the braces on her teeth, Reagan snickered and vigorously nodded her head.
Okay, then it's dumb bird by a landslide, Chris declared triumphantly as she held up the sculpture in the air.
When she lowered it again, she said, I'm going to leave it here to dry for a while, and then I'll put him up in my room, honey. Chris was setting down the bird on a game table a few feet away when she noticed the Ouija board there. She'd forgotten that she had it. As curious about herself as she was about others, she'd originally bought it as a possible means of exposing clues to her subconscious. It hadn't worked, though she'd used it a time or two with Sharon and one other time with Dennings, who had willfully steered the plastic planchette.
Are you the one moving it, ducks? Are you?
So that all of the spirit messages were obscene, and then afterward blamed it on, quote, cunting evil spirits.
You been playing with a Ouija board, Rags, honey? Oh, yeah.
You know how?
Oh, well, sure. Here, Mom, I'll show you.
Reagan was moving to sit before the board.
Oh, well, I think you need two people, honey. No, you don't, Mom. I do it all the time.
Chris was pulling up a chair.
Well,
let's both play, okay? A hesitation. And then, well, okay. The child had her fingertips lightly positioned atop the planchette. And as Chris reached out to position hers, it made a swift, sudden move to the position on the board marked No. Chris smiled at her daughter slyly.
Is a case of mother, I'd rather do it myself. Is that it? You don't want me to play?
No, I do, Mom. Captain Howdy said no.
Captain who?
Captain Howdy.
Honey, who's Captain Howdy?
Oh, you know, I make the questions and he does the answers. Oh, yeah? Yes, he's very nice.
Chris tried not to frown as she began to feel a dim but prickling concern. Reagan had loved her father deeply, yet had never shown the slightest reaction to her parents' divorce. Maybe Reagan cried in her room, who knew? But Chris was fearful that her daughter was repressing both anger and grief, and that one day the dam would break and her emotions would erupt in some unknowable and harmful form. Chris pursed her lips, a fantasy playmate. Didn't sound healthy. And why the name Howdy? For Howard? Her father?
Pretty close.
So how come you couldn't even come up with a name for a dum-dum bird? And then you hit me with something like Captain Howdy? Honey, why do you call him that?
Reagan giggled.
Because that's his name, of course. Says who? Well, him.
Oh, well, of course.
Of course.
And what else does he say to you?
Stuff.
What stuff? Reagan shrugged and looked aside.
I don't know. Just stuff. Well, for instance.
Reagan turned back and said, okay, then I'll show you. I'll ask him some questions. Good idea, honey. Setting the fingertips of both her hands on the heart-shaped beige plastic planchette, Reagan closed her eyes tightly in concentration.
Captain Howdy, do you think my mom is pretty? She asked.
5 seconds passed. Then 10.
Captain Howdy?
No movement. Chris was surprised. She'd expected her daughter to slide the planchette to the section marked yes. What now? She fretted. Some unconscious hostility? She blamed me for losing her father? I mean, what? Reagan opened her eyes, looking stern.
Captain Howdy, that's not very polite, she chided. Honey, maybe he's sleeping, said Chris. Do you think, Mom?
Yeah, and I think you should be sleeping.
Oh, Mom.
Chris stood up. Yeah, come on, honey. Uppy up. Say goodnight to Captain Howdy. No, I won't. He's a poop. Reagan got up and followed Chris up the stairs.
Chris tucked her into bed and then sat on the bedside. Honey, Sunday's no work. You want to do something? Sure, Mom. Like what?
When they'd first come to Washington, Chris had made an effort to find playmates for Reagan. She'd uncovered only one, a 12-year-old girl named Judy. But Judy's family was away for Easter, and Chris was concerned now that Reagan might be lonely for companions her age. Chris shrugged.
Well, I don't know, she said. Something. You want we should drive around town and see the monuments and stuff? Hey, cherry blossoms rags. That's right. They're out early this year. You want to see them? Oh, yeah, Mom. Well, okay. Then tomorrow night, a movie. Oh, I love you, Mom.
Reagan gave her mother a hug, and Chris hugged her back with an extra fervor, whispering,
oh, honey, I love you so.
You can bring Mr. Dennings if you like. Chris pulled back from the hug and looked at Reagan quizzically.
Mr. Dennings? Sure, Mom. It's okay.
Oh, no, it isn't. Honey, why would I want to bring Mr. Dennings?
Well, you like him, don't you?
Well, sure I like him, honey, don't you? Looking off, Reagan made no answer. Her mother eyed her with concern.
Baby, what's going on? Chris prodded.
You're going to marry him, aren't you, Mommy? It was less a question than a sullen statement of fact. Chris exploded into a laugh.
Oh, my baby, of course not. What on earth are you talking about, Burke Dennings? Where'd you get that idea?
But you like him, you said.
I like pizza, but I wouldn't ever marry one. Reagan, he's a friend.
Just a crazy old friend.
You don't like him like Daddy?
Oh, I love your Daddy, honey. I'll always love your Daddy.
Mr. Dennings come by here a lot because, like I told you, he's lonely, that's all. He's just a lonesome, goofy friend. Well, I heard...
You heard?
You heard what?
Heard from who? Whirling slivers of doubt in her eyes. Hesitation. Then a shrug of dismissal.
I don't know, Reagan sighed. I just thought,
well, it's silly, so forget it.
Okay.
Now go to sleep, honey.
I'm not sleepy, Mom. Can I read?
Yeah, read that new book I got you.
Oh, thanks, Mommy.
Good night, honey. Sleep tight.
Night, Mom.
Chris blew her a kiss from the door and closed it, then walked down the stairs to her study.
Kids, she thought. Where do they get their ideas?
She wondered if Reagan had connected Denning somehow to her filing for divorce. Howard had wanted it. long separations, erosion of ego as the husband of a superstar. He'd found someone else. But Reagan didn't know that, only that Chris was the one who had filed. Oh, quit all this amateur psychoanalyzing and try to spend some more time with her, for God's sakes. I mean, really?
In the study, Chris had settled down to read Hope when, halfway through it, she heard steps and looked up to see Reagan coming toward her sleepily while rubbing a knuckle at the corner of an eye.
Hey, honey, what's wrong? There's these real funny noises, Mom.
Noises? In your room?
Yeah, in my room. It's like knocking, and I can't go to sleep.
Where the hell are those traps?
Honey, sleep in my bedroom, and I'll see what it is. Chris led Reagan to the master bedroom and was tucking her in when Reagan asked,
Can I watch TV for a while till I sleep?
Yeah, where's your book?
I can't find it, Mom. Can I watch?
Oh, well, I guess so. Yeah, sure.
Chris picked up the remote from a bedside table and tuned in a channel.
That loud enough, Rags?
Yes, Mom, thank you.
Chris placed the remote on the bed. Okay, honey, now just watch it till you're sleepy, okay? You turn it off. Chris turned out the light and then went down the hall, where she climbed up the narrow green-carpeted stairs that led to the attic, opened the door, felt around for the light switch, found it, flicked it on, and then entered the unfinished attic, where she took a few steps and then stopped and slowly glanced all around. Press clippings and correspondence in boxes were neatly stacked on the pinewood floor. She saw nothing else except the rat traps, 6 of them, baited. Yet the space looked spotless. Even the air smelled clean and cool. The attic was unheated. No pipes, no radiator, no little holes in the roof for entry. Chris took a step forward.
There's nothing, came a voice from behind her.
Chris jumped from her skin. Oh, good Jesus, she gasped, turning quickly and putting a hand to her fluttering heart. Jesus Christ, Carl, don't do that. He was standing 2 steps down on the staircase to the attic.
Very sorry, madam. But you see, madam, everything is clean.
Still a little short of breath, Chris said weakly, Thanks for sharing that with me, Carl.
Yeah? It's clean.
Thanks. That's terrific.
Madam, maybe cat better. Cat better for what, Carl?
To catch rats.
Without waiting for an answer, Carl turned to walk back down the stairs and soon was lost from Chris's sight. For a time, she kept staring at the open doorway as she wondered whether Carl had been subtly insolent. She wasn't sure. She turned around again, looking for some cause of the wrappings. She lifted her gaze to the angled roof. The street was shaded by enormous trees, most of them gnarled and entangled by vines, and the branches of one of them, a massive basswood tree, lightly touched the front third of the house. Was it squirrels after all? Wondered Chris.
Must be.
Or maybe even just the branches. Recent nights had been windy.
Maybe cat better.
Chris turned around and stared at the doorway again.
Pretty smart ass, are we, Carl? She reflected.
Then in a flash, her expression turned pertly mischievous. She went down to Reagan's bedroom, picked something up, brought it back to the attic, and then after a minute went back to the bedroom. Reagan was sleeping. Chris returned her to her room, tucked her into her bed, then went back to her own bedroom, where she turned off the television and went to sleep. That night, the house was especially quiet. Eating her breakfast the following morning, Chris told Carl in an offhand way that during the night she thought she'd heard one of the rat traps springing shut. Like to go and take a look, Carl? Chris suggested, sipping coffee and pretending to be engrossed in the Washington Post, while without any comment, Carl went up to the attic to investigate the matter. As he was returning a few minutes later, Chris passed him in the hall on the 2nd floor.
his gaze straight ahead. He was walking stolidly without any expression, in his hands the large Mickey Mouse doll whose snout he had pried from one of the traps. As he and Chris passed one another, she heard him mutter, "Someone is funny." Chris entered her bedroom, and as she slipped off her robe before dressing for work, she murmured softly, "Yeah, maybe cat better. Much better." When she grinned, her entire face crinkled up. The filming went smoothly that day. Later in the morning, Sharon came by the set, and during breaks between scenes, in her portable dressing room, she and Chris handled items of business. A letter to her agent, she would think about the script. Okay to the White House. A wire to Howard reminding him to telephone on Reagan's birthday. A call to her business manager asking if she could afford to take a year off. And then plans for a dinner party, April 23rd. Early in the evening, Chris took Reagan to a movie, and the following day, they drove around to points of interest in Chris's red Jaguar XKE. The Capitol, the Lincoln Memorial, the cherry blossoms, a bite to eat. Then across the river to Arlington National Cemetery and the tomb of the unknown soldier, where Reagan turned solemn. While later at the grave of John F. Kennedy, she seemed to grow distant and sad. She stared at the eternal flame for a time, and then, mutely reaching up to grip her mother's hand, she said tonelessly, "Mom, why do people have to die?" The question pierced her mother's soul. "Oh, Rags, you too, oh no." And yet what could she tell her? Lies? No, she couldn't. She looked at her daughter's upturned face, at her eyes misting up with tears. Had Reagan sensed her thoughts? She had done it so often before. "Honey, people get tired," she told Reagan tenderly. "Mom, why does God let them?" Looking down at her daughter, Chris was silent. Puzzled. Disturbed. An atheist, she had never taught Reagan religion. She thought it would have been dishonest. "Who's been telling you about God?" she asked. "Sharon." Oh. She would have to speak to her. "Mom, why does God let us get tired?" Looking down at the pain in those sensitive eyes, Chris surrendered. Couldn't tell her what she really believed, which was nothing. "Well, after a while, God gets lonesome for us, Rags. He wants us back." Reagan folded herself into silence. She stayed totally quiet all during the drive home, her mood persisting all the rest of that day and then, disturbingly, all through Monday. On Tuesday, Reagan's birthday, that spell of strange silence and sadness seemed to break. Chris took her along to the filming, and when the shooting day was over, a huge cake with 12 lighted candles on it was brought out while the film's cast and crew sang Happy Birthday. Always a kind and gentle man when sober, Dennings had the lights rewarmed and, loudly calling it a screen test, he filmed the scene as Reagan blew out the candles and cut the cake, and then promised he would make her a star. Reagan seemed cheerful, even gay. But after dinner and the opening of presents, the mood seemed to fade. No word from Howard. Chris placed a call to him in Rome, and was told by a clerk at his hotel that he hadn't been there for several days and that he had left no forwarding number. He was somewhere on a yacht. Chris made excuses. Reagan nodded, subdued, and shook her head to his mother's suggestion that they go to the hot shop for a shake. Without a word, she went down to the basement playroom, where she remained until time for bed. The following morning, when Chris opened her eyes, she found Reagan in bed with her, half awake. "Well, what in Reagan, what are you doing here?" "Mom, my bed was shaking." "Oh, you nut. Chris kissed her and pulled up her covers. Go to sleep, honey. It's still early. What looked like morning was the beginning of endless night. Chapter 2. He stood at the edge of the lonely subway platform, listening for the rumble of a train that was still the ache that was always with him, like his pulse, heard only in silence. He shifted his bag to the other hand and stared down the tunnel. Points of light. They stretched into dark, like guides to hopelessness. A cough. He glanced to the left. A gray stubble derelict, numb on the ground in a pool of his urine, was sitting up, his yellowed eyes fixed on the priest with the chipped, sad face. The priest looked away. He would come. He would whine.
Could you help an old altar boy, Father? Would you?
The vomit-flaked hand pressing down on the shoulder, the fumbling in his pocket for the holy medal, the reeking of the breath of a thousand confessions, with the wine and the garlic and the stale mortal sins belching out all together and smothering, smothering. The priest heard the derelict rising. Oh, don't come. He heard a step.
Oh, my God, let me be.
Hiya, Father. He winced, sagged, couldn't turn. He could not bear to search for Christ again in stench and hollow eyes, for the Christ of pus and bleeding excrement, the Christ who could not be. In an absent gesture, he felt at his coat sleeve as if for an unseen band of mourning. He dimly remembered another Christ.
I'm a Catholic, Father.
The faint rumbling of an incoming train, then sounds of stumbling. The priest turned and looked. The bum was staggering, about to faint, and with a blind, sudden rush, the priest got to him, caught him, dragged him to the bench against the wall.
I'm a Catholic, the derelict mumbled. I'm a Catholic.
The priest eased him down, stretched him out, saw his train. He quickly pulled a dollar from out of his wallet and placed it in the pocket of the derelict's jacket, then decided he might lose it. He plucked out the dollar, stuffed it into a urine-damp trouser pocket, then picked up his bag and boarded the train, sitting in a corner and pretending to sleep until the end of the line, where he climbed up to the street and began the long walk to Fordham University. The dollar had been meant for his cab. When he reached the residence hall for visitors, he signed his name on the register. Damien Karras, he wrote, then examined it. Something was wrong. Then wearily he remembered and added S.J., the abbreviation for Society of Jesus. He took a room in Weigel Hall, and after an hour, he at last fell asleep. The following day, he attended a meeting of the American Psychiatric Association. As principal speaker, he delivered a paper entitled Psychological Aspects of Spiritual Development. And at the end of the day, he enjoyed a few drinks, a bite to eat, with some other psychiatrists. They paid. He left them early. He would have to see his mother. From a subway stop, he walked to the crumbling brownstone apartment building on Manhattan's East 21st Street. Pausing by the steps that led up to the dark oak door, he eyed the children on the stoop. Unkempt, ill-clothed, no place to go. He remembered evictions, humiliations, walking home with a seventh-grade sweetheart and encountering his mother as she hopefully rummaged through a city garbage can on the corner of the street. Karras slowly climbed the steps, smelled an odor like cooking, like warm, damp, rotted sweetness. He remembered the visits to Mrs. Corelli, his mother's friend, in her tiny apartment with the 18 cats. He gripped the banister and climbed, overcome by a sudden, draining weariness that he knew was caused by guilt. He should never have left her. Not alone. On the fourth floor landing, he reached into a pocket for a key and slipped it into the lock. 4C, his mother's apartment. He opened the door as if it were a tender wound. Her greeting was joyful. A shout, a kiss. She rushed to make coffee. Dark complexion, stubby, gnarled legs. He sat in the kitchen and listened to her talk, the dingy walls and soiled floors seeping into his bones. The apartment was a hovel. Social security, and every few months, a few dollars from her brother. She sat at the table, Mrs. This, Uncle That, still in immigrant accents. He avoided those eyes that were wells of sorrow, eyes that spent days staring out of a window. I should never have left her. She could neither read nor write any English, and so later he wrote a few letters for her, and afterward he worked at repairing the tuner on a crackling plastic radio. Her world. The news. Mayor Lindsay. He went to the bathroom. Yellowing newspapers spread on the tile. Stains of rust in the tub and the sink. On the floor an old corset. These, the seeds of vocation. From these he had fled into love. But now the love had grown cold. And in the night, he heard it whistling through the chambers of his heart, like a lost and gently crying wind. At 11:15, he kissed her goodbye, promised to return as soon as he could. He left with the radio tuned to the news. Once back in his room at Weigel Hall, Karras gave some thought to writing a letter to the Jesuit head of the Maryland province. He'd covered the ground with him once before. Request for a transfer to the New York province in order to be closer to his mother. A request for a teaching post and relief from his counseling duties. In requesting the latter, he'd cited as a reason unfitness for the work. The Maryland provincial had taken it up with him during the course of his annual inspection tour of Georgetown University, a function closely paralleling that of an Army Inspector General in the granting of confidential hearings to those who had grievances or complaints. On the point of Damien Karras's mother, the provincial had nodded and expressed his sympathy. But the question of the Jesuits' unfitness, he thought, was contradicted by Karras's record. Still, Karras pursued it, had sought out Tom Birmingham, the Georgetown University president. Look, it's more than psychiatry, Tom. You know that. Some of their problems come down to their vocation, the meaning of their lives. Tom, it isn't always sex that's involved, it's their faith. And I just can't cut it. It's too much. I need out. What's the problem, Damien? Tom, I think I've lost my faith. Birmingham didn't press him on the reasons for his doubt, for which Karras was grateful. He knew that his answers would have sounded insane. The need to rend food with the teeth and then defecate. My mother's 9 first Fridays. Stinking socks. Thalidomide babies. An item in the paper about a young altar boy waiting at a bus stop, set on by strangers, sprayed with kerosene, ignited. No. No, too emotional, vague, existential. More rooted in logic was the silence of God. In the world there was evil, and much of it resulted from doubt, from an honest confusion among men of good will. Would a reasonable God refuse to end it? Not finally reveal himself? Not speak? Lord, give us a sign. The raising of Lazarus was dim in the distant past. No one now living had heard his laughter. And so why not a sign? At various times, Karras longed to have lived with Christ, to have seen him, to have touched him, to have probed his eyes. Oh, my God, let me see you. Let me know. Come to me in dreams. The yearning consumed him. He sat at the desk now, with pen above paper. Perhaps it wasn't time that had silenced the provincial. Perhaps he understood, Karras thought, that finally faith was a matter of love. Birmingham had promised to consider the requests, to try to influence the provincial, but thus far nothing had been done. Karras wrote the letter and went to bed. He sluggishly awakened at 5 a.m., went to the chapel in Weigel Hall to secure a host for the saying of Mass, then returned to his room. Et clamo meus a te veniat, he prayed with murmured anguish, and let my cry come unto thee. He lifted the host in consecration, with an aching remembrance of the joy it once gave him, felt again, as he did each morning, the pang of an unexpected glimpse from afar and unnoticed of a long-lost love. He broke the host above the chalice. Peace I leave you, my peace I give you. He tucked the host inside his mouth and swallowed the papery taste of despair. When the Mass was over, he carefully polished the chalice and then placed it into his bag. He rushed for the 7:10 train back to Washington, carrying pain in a black valise. Chapter 3. Early on the morning of April 11th, Chris made a telephone call to a doctor in Los Angeles to ask him for a referral to a local psychiatrist for Reagan.
Oh, what's wrong?
Chris explained. Beginning on the day after Reagan's birthday, and following Howard's failure to call, she had noticed a sudden and dramatic change in her daughter's behavior and disposition. Insomnia, quarrelsomeness, fits of temper. She kicked things, threw things, screamed, wouldn't eat. In addition, her energy seemed abnormal. She was constantly moving, touching, turning, tapping, running, jumping about. Doing poorly with schoolwork, fantasy playmate, eccentric attention-getting tactics?
Such as what? The physician inquired.
Chris started with the rappings. Since the night she'd checked the attic, she'd heard them again on two occasions, and in both of these instances, she noticed, Reagan was present in the room, and the rappings would cease at the moment Chris entered. Secondly, she told him, Reagan would lose things in a room, a dress, her toothbrush, books, her shoes. She complained about somebody moving her furniture. Finally, on the morning following the dinner at the White House, Chris saw Carl in Reagan's bedroom pulling a bureau back into place from a spot that was halfway across the room. When Chris had inquired what he was doing, he repeated his former, "Someone is funny," and refused to elaborate any further. But shortly thereafter, Chris had found Reagan in the kitchen complaining that someone had moved all her furniture during the night when she was sleeping. And this was the incident, Chris explained, that had finally crystallized her suspicions. It was clearly her daughter who was doing it all.
You mean, somnambulism? She's doing it in her sleep?
No, Mark, no, she's doing it when she's awake, to get attention. Chris mentioned the matter of the shaking bed, which had happened twice more, each time followed by Reagan's insistence that she sleep with her mother.
Well, that could be physical, the internist ventured.
No, Mark, I didn't say that the bed was shaking. What I said was that Reagan said it was shaking.
Well, do you know that it wasn't?
No, not really. Well, it might be clonic spasms, he murmured. What was that? Clonic spasm. Any temperature? No. Listen, what do you think? Chris asked him. Should I take her to a shrink or what? Chrissy mentioned her schoolwork. How's she doing with her math? Her math? Why? How's she doing? He persisted. Well, just rotten. I mean, suddenly rotten. I see. Why'd you ask?
Well, it's part of the syndrome. Syndrome? Syndrome of what? Oh, nothing serious. I'd rather not guess about it over the phone. You got a pencil? He wanted to give her the name of a Washington internist. Mark, can't you come out here and check her yourself? She was remembering Jamie and his lingering infection. Chris's doctor at that time had prescribed a new broad-spectrum antibiotic. Refilling a prescription at a local drugstore, the pharmacist was wary.
I don't want to alarm you, ma'am, but
This what?
Well, it's quite new on the market, and they've found that in Georgia, it's been causing aplastic anemia in young boys.
Jamie. Gone. Dead. Ever since, Chris had never trusted doctors. Only Mark. And even that had taken years.
Mark, can't you?
No, I'm sorry I can't, but look, don't worry. This guy I'm recommending is brilliant. He's the best, Chris. Now get a pencil, would you? Hesitation. Then I've got one. What's the name? She wrote it down and then the telephone number. Chris, call and have him look her over, and then tell him to call me, the internist advised. And forget the psychiatrist for now.
Are you sure, Mark?
He delivered a blistering statement regarding the readiness of the general public to recognize psychosomatic illness while failing to recognize the reverse, that illness of the body was often the cause of seeming illness of the mind. Now what would you say, he proposed as an instance, if you were my internist, God forbid, Chris, and I told you I had headaches, recurring nightmares, nausea, insomnia, and blurring of the vision, and also that I generally felt unglued and was worried to death about my job. Would you say I was neurotic? I'm a bad one to ask, Mark. I know you're neurotic. Those symptoms I gave you are the same as for brain tumor, Chris. Check the body. That's first.
Then we'll see.
Chris telephoned the internist and made an appointment for that afternoon. Her time was her own now. The filming was over. At least for her. Burke Dennings continued loosely supervising the work of the second unit, a special crew filming scenes that were of lesser importance, mostly helicopter shots, various exteriors around the city, as well as stunt work and scenes without any of the principal actors. But Dennings wanted every foot of it to be perfect. The doctor was in Arlington, Samuel Klein. While Reagan sat crossly in an examining room, Klein seated her mother in his office and took a brief case history. She told him the trouble. He listened, nodded, made copious notes. When she mentioned the shaking of the bed, he appeared to frown dubiously. But Chris continued. Mark seemed to think it was kind of significant that Reagan's doing poorly with her math.
Now, why was that?
You mean schoolwork?
Yeah, schoolwork, but math in particular, Doc. What's it mean?
Well, let's wait until I've looked at it, Mrs. McNeil. He then excused himself and gave Reagan a complete examination that included taking samples of her urine and her blood. The urine was for testing of her liver and kidney functions, the blood for a number of checks. Diabetes, thyroid function, red cell blood count looking for possible anemia, and white cell blood count for exotic diseases of the blood. When he'd finished, Klein sat and talked to Reagan, observing her demeanor, and then returned to his office and started to write a prescription. She appears to have a hyperkinetic behavior disorder, he said to Chris as he wrote.
A what?
A disorder of the nerves. At least, we think it is. We don't know yet exactly how it works, but it's often seen in early adolescents, and she shows all the symptoms, the hyperactivity, the temper.
Yeah, her performance in math.
Yeah, the math, Doc. Why the math?
Well, it affects concentration.
He ripped the prescription from the small blue pad and handed it over to Chris.
He said, this is for Ritalin.
What? Methylphenidate. Oh, yeah, that. 10 milligrams twice a day. I'd recommend one at 8 a.m. and the other at 2 in the afternoon. Chris was eyeing the prescription.
What is it, a tranquilizer?
No, it's a stimulant.
A stimulant? She's hiring a kite right now.
Her condition isn't quite what it seems, explained Klein. It's a form of overcompensation and overreaction to depression.
Depression?
Klein nodded. Depression, Chris repeated, looking aside and at the floor in thought. Well, you mentioned her father.
Chris looked up. Do you think I should take her to see a psychiatrist, Doc?
Oh, no. I'd wait and see what happens with the Ritalin. I really think that's the answer. Why don't we wait, like, 2 or 3 weeks?
So you think it's all nerves?
I suspect so.
And those lies she's been telling? This'll stop it?
The doctor's answer puzzled her. He asked her if she'd ever known Reagan to swear or use obscenities.
Funny question, Doc. No, never.
Well, there, you see, that's quite similar to things like her lying. Uncharacteristic from what you tell me. But in certain disorders of the nerves, they can...
Wait a minute. Hold it, Doc.
Where do you ever get the notion that she uses obscenities? I mean, is that what you're saying, or did I misunderstand you?
Klein eyed her curiously for a moment, before cautiously venturing.
Yes, I'd say that she uses obscenities.
What, weren't you aware of it?
I'm still not aware of it. What are you talking about?
Well, she let loose quite a string while I was examining her, Mrs. McNeil.
Are you kidding me, Doc? Such as what?
Klein looked evasive. Well, let's just say that her vocabulary is rather extensive.
Well, like what? I mean, come on, give me an example.
Klein shrugged.
You mean shit or fuck?
Klein relaxed.
Yes, she used those words, he said.
And what else did she say?
I mean, specifically.
Well, specifically, Mrs. McNeil, she advised me to keep my goddamn fingers away from her cunt.
Chris gasped with shock.
She used those words?
Well, it isn't unusual, Mrs. McNeil, and I really wouldn't worry about it at all. As I said, it's just a part of the syndrome.
Looking down at her shoes, Chris was shaking her head.
It's just so hard to believe.
Look, I doubt that she even understood what she was saying.
Yeah, I guess, Chris murmured.
Yeah, that could be.
Try the Ritalin, Klein advised her, and we'll see what develops. And I'd like to take a look at her again in 2 weeks.
Klein consulted a calendar pad on his desk.
Let's make Wednesday the 27th. Would that be convenient?
Yeah, okay.
Subdued and morose, Chris got up from a chair, took the prescription, and crumpled it into a pocket of her coat.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, 27th will be fine.
I'm quite a big fan of yours, Klein told her as he opened the door leading into the hall. An index fingertip pressed to her lips, her head lowered. Chris paused in the doorway, preoccupied. Then she glanced up at the doctor.
You really don't think a psychiatrist, Doc?
I don't know, but the best explanation is always the simplest one, okay? So let's wait. Let's just wait and see.
Klein smiled encouragingly.
He said, try not to worry.
How?
As Chris was driving her home, Reagan asked what the doctor had told her.
Oh, he just said that you're nervous, honey.
That's all?
Yeah,
that's all.
Chris had decided not to talk about her language.
Burke, she must have picked it up from Burke, she thought.
But later, Chris spoke to Sharon about it, asking if she'd ever heard Reagan use that kind of obscenity.
Oh, my God, no, said Sharon, slightly taken aback. Oh, no, never. I mean, not even lately.
But, you know, I think her art teacher...
Yeah, her art teacher made some remark about it.
You mean recently, Sharon?
Yeah, last week.
Yeah, but that woman's so prissy, I just figured maybe Reagan said damn or crap. You know, something like that.
Oh, Sharon, by the way,
Have you been talking to Reagan about religion?
Sharon flushed.
Well, a little, that's all. I mean, it's so hard to avoid Chris. She asks so many questions.
Sharon gave a helpless little shrug.
It's just hard. I mean, how do I answer without telling what I think is a great big lie?
Give her multiple choice. In the days that preceded her scheduled dinner party, Chris was extremely diligent in seeing that Reagan took her dosage of Ritalin. By the night of the party, however, she had failed to observe any noticeable improvement. There were subtle signs, in fact, of a gradual deterioration. Increased forgetfulness, untidiness, and one complaint of nausea. As for attention-getting tactics, although the familiar ones failed to recur, there appeared to be a new one. Reports of a foul, unpleasant smell in Reagan's bedroom. At Reagan's insistence, Chris took a whiff one day and smelled nothing.
You don't smell it, Mom?
You mean, you smell it right now?
Oh, well, sure.
What's it smell like, baby? Reagan had wrinkled her nose.
Well, like something burny.
Oh, yeah? Chris had sniffed yet again, this time more deeply.
Don't you smell it, Mom?
Oh, yeah, now I do.
Why don't we open the window for a while and get some air in, sweetheart?
In fact, Chris had smelled nothing, but had made up her mind that she would temporize, at least until the appointment with the doctor. She was also preoccupied with a number of other concerns. One was arrangements for the dinner party. Another had to do with the script. Although she was still enthusiastic about the prospect of directing, a natural caution had prevented her from making a prompt decision. In the meantime, her agent was calling her daily. She told him that she'd given the script to Dennings for his opinion and said she hoped he was reading and not consuming it. The third and the most important of Chris's concerns was the failure of two financial ventures. A purchase of convertible debentures through the use of prepaid interest and an investment in an oil drilling project in southern Libya. Both had been entered upon for the sheltering of income that would have been subject to enormous taxation. But something even worse had developed. The wells had come up dry, and rocketing interest rates had prompted a sell-off in bonds. These were the problems that her gloomy business manager flew into town to discuss. He arrived on Thursday. Chris had him charting and explaining through Friday, when at last she decided on a course of action that the manager thought wise, though he frowned when she then brought up the subject of buying a Ferrari.
You mean a new one, Chris?
Yeah, why not a new one? You know, I drove one in the picture once. If we wrote to the factory, maybe, and remind them, could be they might give us a deal, don't you think? The manager didn't, and cautioned that he thought such a purchase improvident.
Ben, I made over 800,000 last year, and you're telling me I can't buy a freaking car? Don't you think that's ridiculous? Where'd all the money go?
He reminded her that most of the money was in shelters. Then he listed the various drains on her income. Federal income tax, her state tax, estimated tax on future income, property taxes, commissions to her agent and to him and to her publicist, that added up to 20% of her income, another 1.25% to the Motion Picture Welfare Fund, an outlay for wardrobe in tune with the fashion, salaries to Willie and Carl and Sharon and the caretaker of the Los Angeles home, various travel costs, and finally, her monthly expenses.
Well, would you do another picture this year, he asked her.
Chris shrugged. I don't know. Do I have to?
Yeah, I think perhaps you should.
Elbows propped on her knees, Chris held her wistful face cupped in both hands. As eyeing the business manager moodily, she asked him, "What about a Honda?"
He made no reply.
Later that evening, Chris tried to put all of her worries aside, tried to keep herself busy with making preparations for the next night's party.
Now, let's serve the curry buffet instead of sit down, she told Willie and Carl. We can set up a table at the end of the living room, right?
Very good, madam, Carl answered quickly.
So what do you think, Willie? A fresh fruit salad for dessert?
Yes, excellent, madam, Carl answered.
Thanks, Willie.
She'd invited an interesting mixture. In addition to Burke, show up sober, goddammit, and the youngish director of the second unit, she expected a senator and wife, an Apollo astronaut and wife, two Jesuits from Georgetown, her next-door neighbors, and Mary Jo Perrin and Ellen Cleary. Mary Jo Perrin was a plump and gray-headed Washington psychic. Chris had met her at the White House dinner and liked her immensely. She'd expected to find her austere and forbidding, but you're not like that at all, she'd been able to tell her. Instead, she was bubbly warm and unpretentious. Ellen Cleary was a middle-aged State Department secretary who'd worked in the U.S. Embassy in Moscow when Chris toured Russia. She had gone to considerable effort and trouble to rescue Chris from a number of difficulties and encumbrances encountered in the course of her travels, not the least of which had been caused by the red-headed actress's outspokenness. Chris had remembered her with affection over the years and had looked her up on coming to Washington.
Hey, Cher, which priests are coming? Oh, I'm not sure yet. I invited the president and the dean of the college, but I think that the president's sending an alternate. His secretary called me late this morning and said he might have to go out of town.
Who's he sending? Chris asked with a guarded interest.
Let me see.
Sharon rummaged through scraps of notes.
Oh, yeah, here it is. It's his assistant, Father Joseph Dyer.
Oh. Chris seemed disappointed.
Hey, where's Rags? She asked.
Downstairs.
You know, Sharon, maybe you should start to keep your typewriter there. Don't you think? I mean, that way you can watch her when you're typing. Okay? I don't like her being alone so much.
Yeah, good idea, Chris.
Okay, then. Later. Go on home, Cher. Meditate. Play with horses. The planning and preparations at an end. Chris again found herself turning worried thoughts toward Reagan. She tried to watch television, could not concentrate, felt uneasy. There was a strangeness in the house, like settling stillness, weighted dust. By midnight, all in the house were asleep. There were no disturbances that night.
Chapter 4. She greeted her guests in a lime green hostess costume with long belled sleeves and pants. Her shoes were comfortable and reflected her hope for the evening. The first to arrive was the celebrity psychic Mary Jo Perrin, who came with Robert, her teenage son, and the last was pink-faced Father Dyer. He was young and diminutive, with mischievous eyes behind steel-rimmed spectacles. At the door, he apologized for his lateness. I couldn't find the right necktie, he told Chris expressionlessly. She stared at him blankly, then burst into laughter. Her day-long depression began to lift. The drinks did their work. By 9:45, all were scattered about the living room, eating their dinners in vibrant knots of conversation. Chris filled her plate from the steaming buffet and scanned the room for Mrs. Perrin. Ah, there, on a sofa with Father Wagner, the Jesuit dean. Chris had spoken to him briefly. He had a bald, freckled scalp and a dry, soft manner. Chris drifted to the sofa and folded to the floor in front of the coffee table as the psychic chuckled with mirth.
Oh, come on, Mary Jo, the dean said, smiling, as he lifted a forkful of curry to his mouth.
Yeah, come on, echoed Chris. Oh, hi! Great curry, said the dean. Not too hot, Father?
No, not at all. It's just right. Mary Jo has been telling me there used to be a Jesuit who was also a medium.
And he doesn't believe me, said the psychic with mirth.
Ah, distinguo, corrected the dean. I just said it was hard to believe.
You mean medium? Asked Chris.
Why, of course, said Mary Jo. He even used to levitate.
Oh, I do that every morning, said the Jesuit quietly.
You mean he held seances? Chris asked Mrs. Barron. Well, yes, she answered.
He was very, very famous in the 19th century. In fact, he was probably the only spiritualist of his time who wasn't ever convicted of fraud. As I said, he wasn't a Jesuit, commented the dean. Oh my, but was he ever? The psychic laughed.
When he turned 22, he joined the Jesuits and promised not to work any more as a medium, but they threw him out of France, she laughed even harder, right after a seance that he held at the Tuileries. Do you know what he did?
In the middle of the seance, he told the Empress she was about to be touched by the hands of a spirit child who was about to fully materialize, and when they certainly turned all the lights on, they caught him sitting with his naked foot on the Empress's arm. Can you imagine? The Jesuit was smiling as he set down his plate. Don't come looking for discounts anymore on indulgences, Mary Jo. Oh, come on, Father. Every family's got one black sheep. We were pushing our quota with the Medici popes, he replied.
You know, I had an experience once, Chris began. But the dean interrupted. Are you making this a matter of confession?
Chris smiled and said, No, I'm not a Catholic. Oh, well, neither are the Jesuits, Perrin teased with a smile. Dominican slander, retorted the dean.
Then to Chris he said, I'm sorry, my dear. You were saying?
Well, just that I thought I saw somebody levitate once in Bhutan.
She recounted the story.
Do you think that's possible, she ended? I mean, really?
Who knows, replied the Jesuit dean.
He shrugged. Who knows what gravity is, or matter when it comes to that? Would you like my opinion, interjected Mrs. Perrin. No, Mary Jo, the dean told her. I've taken a vow of poverty. So have I, Chris muttered.
What was that? Asked the dean, leaning forward. Oh, nothing.
Say, there's something I've been meaning to ask you. Do you know that little cottage that's back of the church over there?
She pointed in the general direction.
Oh, Holy Trinity?
Yeah, right. Well, what goes on there?
Oh, well, that's where they say Black Mass, said Mrs. Perrin.
Black who?
Black Mass.
Black Mass, what's that?
Come on, she's kidding, said the dean.
Yes, I know, said Chris, but I'm dumb. I mean, what's a black mass?
Oh, well, basically, it's a travesty on the Catholic mass, explained the dean. It's connected to devil worship.
Good grief. I mean, there really is such a thing?
I really couldn't say.
Although I heard a statistic once about something like maybe 50,000 black masses being said every year in the city of Paris?
You mean now, marveled Chris?
It's just something I heard.
Yes, of course, from the Jesuits' secret service, twitted Mrs. Perrin. Not at all, said the dean. My voices told me. The women laughed.
You know, back in L.A., mentioned Chris, hear an awful lot of stories about witch cults being around. I've often wondered if it's true.
Well, as I said, I wouldn't know, said the dean.
But I tell you who might, Joe Dyer. Where's Joe?
The dean looked around.
Oh, there he is, over there.
He nodded toward the other priest, who was standing at the buffet with his back to them, heaping a second helping onto his plate.
Hey, Joe?
The young priest turned, his face impassive. You called, great dean? The dean beckoned with his fingers. Just a second, answered Dyer, turning back to resume his attack on the curry and salad. That's the only leprechaun in the priesthood, said the dean with fondness. He sipped at his wine.
They had a couple of cases of desecration in Holy Trinity Church last week, and Joe said something about one of them reminding him of some of the things they used to do at Black Mass, so I expect he knows something about it.